Gaddafi's point guard. Really. Today, October 23rd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Today, the story of Alex Owumi, born in Nigeria, raised in Boston, played college hoops in Mississippi. Then a couple of years ago, he ended up playing pro ball in Libya, right before the revolution.
And he said, yeah, this is the apartment of Muammar Gaddafi's son, the leader of the 3rd Brigade, the army. And I was like, whoa, this is something crazy.
We'll hear what Owumi did when the fighting broke out all around him. And later, China cracks down hard on those who spread internet rumors.
The thinking is you have to sometimes, you know, show an iron hand. You have to crush a few cockroaches to make the other ones scurry away.
Plus, World Series fever grips Boston and Tokyo.
Japan has a lot of Boston fans.
The Sox can thank closer Koji Uehara for that.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS, with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, premiering Monday night at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Here's something you don't see every day, not even here in the U.S. A newspaper using its front page to plead with police for the release of one of its reporters. And this is in China. That's what the New Express did today. It's a state-run tabloid in southern China. And last week, one of its investigative reporters was detained for what the authorities called damage to the business reputation of a major construction company. The paper says the reporter was only doing his job. David Wertheim is an editor for Foreign Policy magazine, and he's been following the story. I mean, perhaps the reporter was doing his job, David, but he was practicing Western journalism in China. So tell us more about the focus of his reporting, the company Zoomlion. What was this journalist Chen Yongzhu digging into, and how did the company react?
Well, Chen Yongzhu was digging into Zoomlion's revenue figures. What was released on this paper, Xinkuai Bao, which is translated roughly as New Express, is the fact that there was this exclusive investigation in which, you know, Chen basically came across this information. And this actually isn't, surprisingly, the first time that the New Bulletin has run reports that have questioned the Zoomlion bottom line.
Explain to us what kind of company Zoomlion is. What do they do?
Zoomlion is a Chinese heavy equipment manufacturer. They make, in particular, vehicles that are involved with construction and with sanitation. They're a company that's listed on the Shenzhen and the Hong Kong stock exchanges. And Zoomlion is a taxpayer, significantly, in the city of Changsha.
So, David, tell us more about Chen Yongzhou. Why was he arrested? What were the reasons given?
Well, the crime of which Chen Yongzhou was accused was of harming a business's reputation. Generally, in order to be guilty of this crime, and it's a crime significantly, not a civil action, you actually have to be deliberately fabricating false facts.
Was anybody from the government or from Law and Order able to prove that?
So far, I haven't seen any proof, and no proof has come to light. Of course, the Changsha police have said on their official Weibo account that that this is still under investigation. So it's hard to say for certain quite yet.
So we've got a government, a partially government-owned company and a state-run newspaper. I mean, isn't this kind of like playing romper room? I mean, they're both run by the state. Is an arrest like this, what does it actually mean?
It's very frequent for both commercial and media entities within China to have a significant relationship with the state, whether they're partly state-owned, whether it's simply that they pay a great deal of taxes, or that they're subject to heavy state regulation and, of course, ultimately the whims of the Communist Party.
Do you think the Chinese central government would prefer that we not be talking about this?
I'm sure they would. There's already been a directive issued from the Ministry of Propaganda essentially saying that these stories should not be run, discussions of Chen Yongzhou in this incident. It's however, a case of letting the genie out of the bottle. And it's very true, although Chinese social media is censored, nonetheless, once these stories take on a life of their own, it's very hard to pull them back.
The bottle's open. David Wertheim, editor for Foreign Policy Magazine, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Marco.
There's another way the Chinese government is reining in social media. It's cracking down on what it calls online rumor mongering. Ruth Morris has a story from Shanghai.
500 million Chinese use social media, in particular the microblogging site Sina Weibo. So I'm logging onto Sina Weibo and I'm looking at what's trending. And there's this thread about breakfast foods made to look like animals. And that might seem like pretty light fare. But underneath the blueberry foam turtle post is this thread about how Starbucks is charging more for coffee in China than London or Chicago. And what's interesting are the comments here, because a lot of people are mocking the state broadcaster for airing this story in the first place. For example, there's this one post. It basically says, I don't even drink Starbucks, but I have this hope that I will be able to eat safe food and breathe clean air. And then it says, government, will my children realize these hopes? Will they? So China's official media, they have to toe the party line. But Weibo is a pretty freewheeling place. And online celebrities can wield huge influence. This is the movie star and singer Chen Kun. Justin Bieber may have a record-breaking 46 million followers on Twitter, but Chen Kun's got 61 million on Weibo. He's what's known as a big V, V for verified. Posts by big Vs can spark a wildfire of criticism and outrage, some of it aimed at public officials. Jeremy Goldcorn is with Danway.com, which tracks Chinese media. He says Beijing's anti-rumor campaign is really about controlling what's said on social media, especially if it might lead to protests. And he says that's put the big Vs in the line of fire.
The thinking is you have to sometimes, you know, show an iron hand. You have to crush a few cockroaches to make the other ones scurry away.
Goldcorn says one of the first to get crushed was Charles Shui. Shui is a Chinese-American investor and philanthropist with more than 12 million Weibo followers. He posted about official corruption and publicized cases of poor Chinese who couldn't afford medical treatment, but he fell afoul of authorities. In this prime-time televised confession, Shui tells investigators he fielded hundreds of requests by followers every day to publicize their problems. He says, I felt like an emperor reviewing administrative documents. Most of the time, I didn't check whether those Weibo posts were true or not. Officially, Shui was detained on suspicion of paying for sex. But under Chinese law, you can now go to jail for 3 years if you post false and defamatory rumors that are reposted more than 500 times. So people like Zhu Dake take precautions. Zhu is a professor and culture critic at Tongji University in Shanghai. He shows me his Weibo account, which has nearly 100,000 followers. Zhu says he's always careful to post information that originates with official media outlets. Then he adds his own comment. He's still worried, though. He says the law against spreading online rumors is like a noose that will continue to tighten. But Goldcorn of Danway thinks it won't have the desired effect.
Chinese internet users are too numerous and too obstreperous to be silenced by a campaign like this.
Goldcorn says the official media essentially remain propaganda organs, and the Chinese know it, so they're inclined to trust almost any rumor over the government's line.
They've kicked the can down the road in a way, in the sense that they've frightened some people into being a bit more quiet, I imagine. But they haven't convinced anybody in the public that the official sources of information are more trustworthy. And that's the problem they're going to have to deal with sooner or later.
Plus, the Chinese government itself relies on social media to track public opinion. Critics say the anti-rumor campaign is about curbing commentary that might threaten social stability, not about fact-checking the internet. Soon after Charles Shui's mea culpa, police arrested a 16-year-old who used social media to criticize the handling of an apparent suicide. He speculated the dead man was actually thrown from the roof of a karaoke club and that police were covering it up. The teenager was charged with spreading rumors and inciting demonstrations. But netizens were incensed, and they took to Weibo to vent. A week later, the teenager was released. For The World, I'm Ruth Morris in Shanghai.
For the past week, Maria's picture has been all over the front pages of Europe. She's the pale, blonde-haired, blue-eyed child who was found living with a darker-skinned Roma couple in Greece. A DNA test found her to be unrelated to the couple, and police are investigating whether the girl's a victim of child trafficking. A similar case, also involving a blonde child, has emerged in Ireland, except there, a DNA test has reportedly proved that the girl is part of the Roma family she was with. Allegations of child trafficking by the Roma, also known as Romani or Gypsies, are not new in Europe, but the spotlight on their communities is especially hot right now, according to Jake Bowers. He's a Roma journalist based in London and an advocate on behalf of his community.
Well, it's shocking the level of hysteria that there is in Europe over this issue. Shocking on many levels. Firstly, the children can be taken from their families just because they look differently from their parents. But also shocking because the way that the media is reporting it feeds straight upon a very old stereotype that Gypsy people, Romani people, are people who are prone to child snatching. It's a very old European myth which you find built into nursery rhymes like the one we have in England. My mother said I never should play with the gypsies in the wood, and it's being repeated as fact. Gypsy people across Europe are frightened. They're scared that their children are going to be taken off them if they look a little bit different from them.
Let's take some of those stereotypes apart. I mean, what's striking about the story is that these children were taken away because they looked different, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, not stereotypical Roma. So, I mean, you yourself have light hair, right?
That's right. Well, it was white blonde when I was a child. It's increasingly grey, particularly at the moment. But, you know, I'm fair-skinned. I have blue eyes, as do many Romani people across Europe, even in countries like Romania with massive Romani populations, the majority of which are dark, it's true. But there are many families that have blonde children. So on that basis alone, to kind of judge Gypsy people as being guilty before proven innocent, the community is scared that these horrible parts of our history are about to replay themselves.
So I think for a lot of Americans, this is an unfamiliar world, but there does seem to be a cultural clash between nomadic Roma communities and settled Europeans. Do you think that clash contributes to these incidents?
That is the background noise to all of this stuff, that there is undeniably a cultural clash between the Roma community and some settled communities across Europe. We still have an outlook on the world which is nomadic. So we see ourselves as probably really the only real true Europeans, and that Europe is our home, and we feel that we have the right to be everywhere. But there is also this problem that the Roma people across Europe are highly impoverished and highly socially excluded. So there are very real problems with Roma people begging in European cities, which of course a lot of people in places like Paris, Madrid, Dublin, London are very aggravated about. But just because a community, because of its poverty, may indulge in begging does not therefore mean that it's involved in widespread child trafficking or snatching.
The whole drama does seem, as you've indicated, to amount to hysteria over the question, gypsy or not a gypsy, and I use that word with reservations. What do you think this story and all narratives like it tell you about the way people continue to react to the Roma people across Europe?
I think the narrative and the way that it's going shows that there's a profound ignorance about who we are, where we're from, and what we've contributed to European history and culture. It's symptomatic of the great cultural divide that there is between what I would say is settled European society and the Roma community.
Jake Bowers, Roma journalist based in London. He advocates on behalf of the Romani community. Jake, great to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS, with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, premiering Monday night at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're going to hear a story now, one you've probably never heard. It's about a basketball player born in Nigeria but raised in Boston. He played hoops for Alcorn State in Mississippi before embarking on a professional career overseas, far, far from the NBA, which is how, in December 2010, he wound up drafted by a team in Libya on the eve of the revolution there.
In Libya's history. Within the past hour, President Obama welcomed the fall of Gaddafi, but warned many challenges lie ahead.
This is a momentous day in the history of Libya. The dark shadow of tyranny has been lifted, and with this enormous promise, Libyan people now have...
My name is Alex Awumi, and I was the main basketball player for Muammar Gaddafi's team in Benghazi called Al-Nasser Benghazi, and I survived the Libyan revolution.
Alex Awumi played for the local pro basketball team in Benghazi, but as he just mentioned, it was more than that. Al-Nasser was Gaddafi's team, a favorite of the dictator who was about to be toppled. And this is Awumi's story, in his own words, about how that time in Libya changed him for the rest of his life.
You know, I would never be the same Alex I was before that. I had to be selfish at that point. Because if I wasn't, I wouldn't be here telling the story today. When I first got there, the atmosphere on the team was, everybody was pretty down. And I kind of figured out that it wasn't because of the coach, because of the coach was a nice guy. So I found out that, you know, I asked my teammate that these guys were actually getting physically wounded, beaten, because they were losing games. And, you know, physically beaten, bruises on their arms, black eyes. And I'm like, hold on, you know. And I felt kind of bad because I was this, you know, this professional brought in. But I actually kind of took a liking to all those guys and built a relationship with them. And I, you know, it got to a point where I was like, you know, winning is not just important for me, it's important for them. The first time I realized something was changing in the country was, you know, I used to hang out with my teammates. And, you know, these guys were telling me, like, you know, the revolution from Egypt is going to spread to Libya. And I was saying to myself, you know, there's no way you guys are going to overthrow this this dictator that's been here for 42 years. And, you know, around February 12th, February 13th, protesters started, you know, they were all over the city. In small groups, probably groups of seven, you know, spread out here and there. Then the groups got bigger, 7 to 20, 20 to 30, 30 to 40, 40 to 100. And that's when I was like, you know, this is something different. And then February 14th, it kicked off, and that's when it happened. That morning when I went up to my roof, I thought it was just, you know, basic military guys. It looked like they were trying to disperse a crowd, a large crowd. You know, this 100 turned into 300, maybe even more. They had them, you know, the machine guns with the jeeps with the machine, semi-automatic machine guns on the top. I never thought they would use them. As the military men inched closer to the protesters were, you know, it almost looked like a collision. At one point, I was like, you know, somebody's going to stop, you know, and... Instead of the military men stopping, they kept going. Then they let off rounds and rounds out their machine guns. I mean, it was probably one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my life. I remember I had a bottle of water in my hand, and that bottle left my hand and it dropped in slow motion. It was like I was like in a movie, like everything was slow. It was like I fell fast. I hit the floor before the bottle of water hit the floor. That's how slow the bottle was going. Everything just froze. And I've never in my wildest dreams thought that, you know, they were gunned down, 100 to 200 people. And in less than a minute, you could just see the, like, you know, it was like a pack of ants just falling. Like, you know, I could hear the shells hitting the ground. Ting, 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 ting.
These images are said to show the flag of independence being raised over Benghazi. With Libya in turmoil, some European countries are beginning...
After that, I was trying to ring everybody I could, my team president, my teammate, ring home, nothing happened. And at that time, I was looking out the window, and it got worse around me. I mean, literally outside of my building, like, you know, bodies were there. These jeeps with machine guns were driving around. It was no room for me to go downstairs and peek my head out the door and try to escape to somewhere because... I was in downtown. That 1 hour ended up turning into 16 days. 16 days exactly. So 16 days, I was confined in my apartment no water, no food, you know, no electricity, no way of getting to the outside world. The way my strategy was, you know, just get out how you can, just survive how you can. And if that meant eating roaches and worms, then that's what it had to do. If that meant drinking out of a toilet, that's what it was, you know. And I started questioning myself, and I started, you know, I kind of felt, you know, evil spirits on my shoulder. And I started seeing things, you know, having suicidal thoughts. Like, you know, I was just so stressed out. I was delusional, you know, but those are the things I had to do to survive. And, you know, I'm proud to say that I did do them, and I'm still here to this day. The 16 days finally ended when I got a call from my teammate Mustafa. And when I say I got a call is, you know, periodically I was checking my phone, turning it on, trying to make calls to see if it worked. And one time I did, I actually left it on. And thank God, when I did leave it on, he called me and my battery didn't die. And he told me that my team president hired a driver to drive us to Egypt. We made it out of there. Faith, you know, faith plays a major role in moments like that, because, you know, when I find I'm in a jam or anything, I turn to God. You know, my go-to is the Lord's Prayer. When I left Libya, when I finally got home, I figured it all out that this whole time, it wasn't me planning out my life. God had a plan for me. No matter how you grow up, no matter what circumstance you've been in, there's a plan. God has made a plan for you. It's a straight line. You can go left or you can go right. You can try to make your own plan for yourself. At the end of the day, you're going to end up back on that line going forward.
Alex Owumi is now back on the free throw line going forward with his new team in Britain, the Worcester Wolves. He took a break from practice to tell his story to the world's Leo Hornack. See the view from Owumi's house in Benghazi during the fighting. We've got the picture at PRI.org. Yesterday, we told you the story of David Tran. He's the guy behind the famous bottle with the green cap, Hoi Fong Foods Sriracha Hot Sauce. I spoke to quartz journalist Roberto Ferdman, who's written about Tran, coming here from Vietnam and starting his sriracha business in the 1980s by selling the addictive hot sauce to the local Vietnamese community in L.A. Our story sparked an online debate as to the true origins of the sauce. Lots of you commented that sriracha rightly belongs to the district of Siraja, east of Bangkok in Thailand, as opposed to Vietnam, like we suggested. One commenter wrote on our website that the original sriracha sauce from Thailand and the sriracha sauce from Hoi Fong Foods are very different. Andy Sukramani posted a comment saying that the Thai original is a bit more sweet and spicy than Tran's version. Thanks to everyone who weighed in at PRI.org and on social at Twitter and Facebook. And be sure to add your thoughts about how you use sriracha. We've gotten some interesting responses ranging from a sriracha and Greek yogurt dip to a sriracha donut. Yep, hot sauce on a donut, go figure. Do you have a favorite sriracha dish? Let us know at PRI.org. And this is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, from the Bronx to Addis Ababa, hip-hop's message stays the same.
People of different ethnic groups whose parents, you know, have been in conflict, they're coming together on the same tracks, the same way that warring gangs would use breakdancing to, you know, vent frustrations, but also to build community in a constructive way.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS, with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, premiering Monday night at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The skies outside of Australia's largest city are thick with smoke today as the region enters its second week of intense wildfires. Officials say roughly 60 fires are still raging near Sydney. And as The World's environment editor Peter Thompson reports, the debate over whether climate change is playing a role in the fires is raging as hot as the fires themselves.
Police say some of the fires in the Blue Mountains west of Sydney may have been started by children. others by power lines being buffeted by strong winds. One was even started by an army training exercise gone wrong. But the biggest culprit has been the weather. It's been dry, windy, and unseasonably hot in the upper 80s in the early spring.
Today's conditions were a perfect storm for bushfire conditions.
That's Taylor Auerbach, a reporter with News Corp in Australia. The fires began last week and have so far consumed roughly 300,000 acres of land and more than 200 homes. They've closed schools and sent many local residents down the hills to wait out the danger in Sydney. And Auerbach says they've brought the largest ever mobilization of emergency services in the state of New South Wales.
We're talking maybe 3,000 volunteer firefighters rolling out from places as far afield as New Zealand.
But even that hasn't been up to the task. At last count, 19 fires were still out of control. And Auerbach says new ones can start virtually without warning.
You can be looking at a rather nondescript patch of bush in the Australian outback, and all of a sudden you'll see a little bit of smoke and then a tiny flame, and literally within seconds you'll have a roaring inferno, and the wind creates a tornado of fire in the treetops. And that heat is just so intense, your eyes water, and every sense in your body is just overwhelmed by the power of nature at that moment.
Of course, fire is no stranger to Australia. It's been a big part of life and the landscape there for millennia. But New South Wales Rural Fire Services Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons says conditions this year are off the charts.
Never before have we seen the extent of damage and destruction and wide-scale fire activity at this time of the year. It's indicative of the unseasonably hot, dry conditions that have been building now throughout winter and into spring.
I'm very concerned about the rest of this summer.
That's Edward Kerr, who lives in the Blue Mountains town of Blackheath, but who's taking refuge this week in Sydney.
I'm concerned about, you know, that this might be the first of four or five trips down to Sydney for me. It's unprecedented to have this sort of hot weather in October. This is the sort of weather that we expect in our hottest month, which is February.
And even in this land of extremes, unprecedented is becoming a regular part of the Australian lexicon when it comes to weather. Australia has seen a rash of extreme weather events in recent years, and this year's heat and fires are just stoking the raging debate in Australia over whether or not the effects of climate change are already being felt in the country. That debate helped bring down the government of former Prime Minister Julia Gillard earlier this year. Her replacement, Conservative Tony Abbott, has been an outspoken critic of mainstream climate science and came into office promising to get rid of the carbon tax that Gillard had put in place to help address climate change pollution. He's blasted talk of climate change being even partly responsible for this week's fires.
Look, fire is a part of the Australian experience.
That's Abbott speaking this week on a Melbourne radio station.
But these fires are certainly not a function of climate change. They're just a function of life in Australia.
Abbott reserves special scorn for the United Nations climate official Cristina Figueres, who said this week that there was absolutely a connection between wildfires and rising temperatures. Abbott said Figueres was talking through her hat. But climate scientists say it's Abbott who's got the science wrong.
Well, I'm on the side of Cristina Figueres here.
Kevin Trenberth is a distinguished senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado.
Australia is one of the countries which is most vulnerable to the effects of climate change, and I think the Australians ought to be very worried.
That's over the medium to long term, of course. In the meantime, whatever their feelings about climate change, Australians have fires to put out and possibly a long, hot summer ahead of them. For The World, I'm Peter Thompson.
There seems to be no end to the ongoing disaster that is the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan. The main problem lately is water, radioactive water, that continues to spill from the plant. Just last week, heavy rains caused yet another spill. Well, we're about to speak to a reporter in Japan who brings a unique perspective to this story. As a kid, he lived just some 70 miles from Chernobyl when that nuclear disaster happened.
During the May 1st sort of Communist Party celebrations, everyone was out in the street parading, waving red flags. And I remember my father saying that during that day it rained an odd kind of yellow, orange, rusty kind of colored rain. And he said he felt extremely sick.
We'll hear more of Yuri Humber's childhood memories of the Chernobyl disaster in a moment, but first to the story that Yuri's covering now. He's been on the Fukushima beat for Bloomberg ever since the March 2011 earthquake and tsunami crippled the plant there. The utility that owns it, TEPCO, has been struggling to keep the disaster under control, and Humber says TEPCO's response to the radioactive water leaks relies on using emergency holding tanks that were never intended to be a long-term solution.
They hastily put together a lot of tanks. Some of the tanks were essentially, there weren't even one structure. It was several wall parts bolted together. So they had to put these up quickly. And these tanks weren't exactly designed to last for a long time or be used for such things as holding contaminated water.
So with all this in the background, how are the people of Fukushima, after 2 years of watching the government and TEPCO, the utility, kind of thrash around with incompetence, are they increasingly concerned that their home is really unlivable and will be possibly unlivable for the rest of their lifetimes?
There's a lot of the people from Fukushima who have been fairly grim and realistic from the start. I think one of the town mayors just said, I aim to get everyone back to our town in 30 years. He wasn't ever talking about 2 years or 3 years. He said 30 years. But realistically, I think anyone who is younger, who has children, they have tried to start life away from the site.
You know, Yuri, it's interesting. You're in the unique position of being familiar with not just this nuclear accident. You're from Belarus, and the town you're from is on the border with Ukraine, a mere 70 miles or so from Chernobyl, where the nuclear plant there suffered its own disaster, the worst such event ever. That was in 1986. You were 6 years old. What do you recall of that moment?
One strange visual that I still remember, and that's standing by my grandfather watching TV and being told about a nuclear accident. Of course, I was only six, as you said, so it didn't have a great sort of impact on me right then. But I remember everyone else in the room being completely quiet. The worst thing about the Soviet disasters compared to the Fukushima accident, I would say, though, is that the item on the news, which I watched as a young child, would have been about 2.5, maybe 3 weeks after the actual accident. Mm. What happened under the Soviet system was that the authorities, first of all, didn't take it very seriously. Secondly, they were very concerned about panic spreading. And people who were able during the communist time to illicitly listen to foreign radio essentially picked up on this news and started spreading it, you know, just word of mouth. In Fukushima, there's certainly concern that the government and definitely the company perhaps not telling us the full truth and presenting it as absolutely normal, as absolutely fine. But by this point, the public just don't trust that. But on the other hand, people can today in Japan check other resources, you know, decide for themselves, essentially, do they want to consume food grown in Fukushima or areas around Fukushima, or do they want to stay away from that? So I think despite all the problems of Fukushima, at least there is greater awareness of what's going on.
I'm wondering if, you know, living in Tokyo and watching what's happening 2 hours up the road in Fukushima, is there a parallel to how you perceived or your family perceived what was going on in Chernobyl on the other side of the border in Belarus? I mean, radiation, after all, doesn't obey any borders. Is it a similar feeling in Tokyo?
Oh, for sure. Immediately after the disaster, there were a lot of quite hysterical messages, people saying, get out, you have to leave. I have to say my family, the ones that lived through Chernobyl, were actually a lot calmer. I don't know if this is because it's a second time round.
Yuri Humber, a journalist with Bloomberg News, speaking with us from Tokyo. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
If people in Japan are looking for a distraction from their Fukushima woes, how about a little World Series? Fenway Park is just a short distance from our studios, and that's where the World Series is getting underway tonight between the Red Sox and the Cardinals. Sports writer Masashi Yamazaki is a regular at Fenway Park. Masashi, you cover the Red Sox for sports fans back in Japan. I'm sure you've had your eyes on the bullpen here in Boston for a while now, where Japanese ace pitcher Koji Yohara spends most innings. What do you like about the 38-year-old right-hander?
Very consistent. You know, throw strikes, dominate against any batter, any team. So he pitched 73 games this year. This is the highest for him in his 15th professional career. So that was a surprise.
Have you met him?
Yes.
What's he like?
I don't know. He doesn't see, you know, the future. He looks every single game.
That's a very Zen attitude, to be in the present.
He doesn't see, you know, next week. He only see, you know, if you finish today's game, he's ready to next game.
Now, contrast that with the other earlier fastball pitcher from Japan, Daisuke Matsuzaka. What's the difference between him and Koji?
Different type of pitcher. Daisuke needs to pitch, you know, he's a starting pitcher. Koji was a starting pitcher, but he converted to bullpen pitcher since 2010. Daisuke needs the time. He needs to warming up, you know, he needs a time to warming up. But Koji doesn't need time to warming him up, so it's a big difference.
What kind of pitches does Koji throw?
He only has two pitches, fastball and split. He learned to throw the split finger fastball last year. It's not easy to control the split in any pitcher, but he can do it. So he mentioned he has two or three kind of split, how he wants to, you know, move, a late movement split. So I think he's still learning, but he already, you know, got a high level split.
Do you know many Japanese fans who have flown over to support Boston or the Cardinals?
Japan has a lot of Boston fans because Daisuke played, and this year Koji has a dominant. Also, Tazawa has been a great job.
Is Koji growing his beard? That seems to be the Red Sox thing to do right now in the postseason.
No. He had a beard. No huge sideburns when he played for Texas Orioles, but he shaved last offseason. In Japanese culture, coaches, managers don't like players to have the beard, the mustache. That's kind of, you know, Japanese culture.
Here's another thing about Japanese culture that I'm curious about. Do you see more Japanese culture entering American baseball culture? Like, will we be able to buy a bento box at Fenway in the near future?
I don't think so. If somebody does, you know, I'm happy, but I don't think so. You know, I like hot dogs and pizza and something like that. You know, especially we can have a, you know, clam chowder soup in Fenway. So that's huge, you know.
You got to love it, right?
Yeah.
Final question. Who's going to win it and in how many games?
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, good game, good series. But starting pitcher, St. Louis has a more, you know, great starting pitchers, but Boston has a great, a much better bullpen. So I think the key is the bullpen. My prediction is a 4-2 Boston.
The key is in the bullpen and the key is in Koji, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Sports journalist Masashi Yamazaki, thank you so much for stopping by on your way to Fenway Park.
Thank you so much.
A quick update now on a story we've been following out of Germany. It's about a Catholic bishop there named Franz Peter Tebartz von Elst. He's been dubbed the luxury bishop, or Bishop Bling, by the German press. This after an internal Vatican audit revealed that he spent more than $40 million on his residence. The bishop has also been indicted for perjury, for lying about expenses for a flight to India. All this at a time when Pope Francis has been trying to stress humility and service to the poor. Revelations about the German bishop's less than austere lifestyle have angered many German Catholics. Christian Weisner is with a German lay Catholic association.
This is really a very, very sad story about the church in Germany. After the sexual abuse scandal discovered 3 years ago, this is a second bomb, I would say, in the German church. And with this huge and enormous costly building of a new bishop's house, the whole Catholic Church lost its credibility.
Well, on Monday, Pope Francis held an audience with Bishop Tebartz von Elst. If anyone was hoping for a formal public reprimand after that meeting, it did not come. But today there is a bit more news about Tebartz von Elst. Pope Francis has suspended him and ordered the bishop to leave his diocese for an unspecified period. The Central Committee of German Catholics, a lay group, welcomed the decision. It noted that there needs to be a careful examination of the evidence in the case. Trust, a spokesperson said, can only be regained through transparency. And given the bishop's expenditures, I doubt the committee was talking about diamonds. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. In theaters now.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Raila Odinga is in town here in Boston. He was the prime minister of Kenya for 5 years until this past April when he lost a controversial presidential election. That vote had Kenyans on edge, but it was nothing compared to the trauma Kenyans went through last month. I'm talking about the siege at Nairobi's Westgate Mall, where 67 people were killed after the upscale shopping center was attacked by extremist militants. Earlier today, I asked former Prime Minister Odinga how Kenyans are making sense of the attack a month later.
Kenyans, first of all, were shocked by what happened, the sheer audacity of people taking over the mall and doing what they do, killing with impunity. But Kenyans are now even more shocked at the behavior of their security forces, as shown in the video on the television, soldiers looting property of victims of this violence. We have said that a proper investigation must be carried out.
How is that behavior even possible among Kenya's military?
This is what actually surprised everybody, because the image that has been created over the years is that our military is highly disciplined and highly professional. So this has come as a great surprise to everybody. And it is really a wake-up call.
Where is most of Kenya's anger directed right now?
I think it is at the military rather than the police, because they say that the police were acting more professionally in dealing with these terrorists, that they had more or less brought the situation under control when the army intervened.
So Al-Shabaab, as you know, says the siege was retaliation for Kenya's military involvement in Somalia. Shouldn't Kenya leave that sort of military incursion to other countries instead of getting involved in the war of a neighbor?
As a prime minister, I was responsible jointly for taking the decision to send our troops to Somalia. And while we have no regrets, I still believe that it was the correct decision. Initially, Kenya had desisted from sending our troops because we have a border with Somalia. But there have continued to be attacks on our territory. And they had also even attacked our tourist resorts.
You've been here in the States for about 10 days. Have you been finding yourself in sort of a defensive position, trying to convince Americans that Kenya's okay, that it's safe?
I know that, a number of Americans actually realize that in a day you're safer in Nairobi than you're in Chicago, for example. These kind of attacks are isolated. They can happen in any part of the world, as they did happen here in Boston during the marathon. So I would really want to appeal to the U.S. government not to scare away Americans from coming to Kenya.
We've spoken with Kenyans since the siege on the Westgate Mall who said the country was actually pulling together around that tragedy. I mean, you know better than anyone what a deeply ethnically divided place Kenya can be. Is it now back to politics as usual, though?
The Westgate attack was basically on the nation of Kenya, and it brought the Kenyan people together to unite because there was a common enemy who had invaded from outside the country. That has not yet resolved the internal contradictions and differences between various ethnic communities. There's still need now for a dialogue to deal with this issue.
Raila Odinga, the former prime minister of Kenya, speaking with us from Boston University. If Odinga plans to run for president again in 2017, he might find composers for a campaign theme song in neighboring Ethiopia. Or he could just use this.
Gotta give us what we need.
Hope you're old enough to remember Public Enemy and Fight the Power. It's a cue for us to catch up with our friends from the Beatmaking Lab. For regular listeners, you know that on Wednesdays, we've been checking in with Pierce Freelon and his partner in music, Stephen Levitin, a.k.a. Applejuice Kid, to talk about their Beatmaking Lab project. The labs teach students around the globe how to produce hip-hop beats. Their latest lab is in Ethiopia, and today Pierce Freelon is going to give us an update. Pierce joins us from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And Pierce, we kick things off with Public Enemy as a reminder that hip-hop started in the U.S. as a tool for social justice, and it's exactly what the focus is of your video this week from the Beatmaking Lab in Addis Ababa. Tell us about that video and what's happening.
Well, first of all, thank you for the comparison, because Chuck D is one of my idols, and that's a huge honor to be, you know, mentioned in the same breath as him. But yeah, so in Addis this week, we tapped into some of their spoken word scene. One of our students, Marta, kicks a poem about some of the health issues in her community. It's over a beat produced by Applejuice Kid, and one of our translator instructors did the musical production, and our student Marta did the lyrics. You know, very, very powerful story about a woman who's died giving childbirth. And it, you know, kind of goes back to the whole theme, the reason why we're there in Addis Ababa with IntraHealth is to use music and hip-hop and spoken word in these mediums to get youth to talk about what some of the health issues in their communities are. When you give a prompt like that, you know, you don't always know what's going to come out, but the words were so powerful.
Are any of the participants in Addis in the Beatmaking Lab asking you questions about the history of hip-hop, you know, specifically the way it's developed from people who were expressing anger and frustration about inequality, about racism, about sexism, and has now kind of landed in this zone, which is obsessed with money, guns, and Hennessy?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that it is something that we discuss. And just an example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, I see hip hop being used very much as it was used on the streets in the Bronx when it was in its infancy. You know, when you had people like Africa Bambaataa, you know, he was a gang member, he was part of the Black Spades, but used hip hop to transform his community and turn it to something positive. I see the same thing happening in community centers like Yole Africa, where, you know, people of different ethnic groups whose parents, you know, have been in conflict, they're coming together on the same tracks, you know, just the same way that, you know, warring gangs would use breakdancing to, you know, vent frustrations, but also to build community in a constructive way.
Pierce Freelon, one of the two brains behind the Beatmaking Lab. If you want to see Marta's video, you should. It's all at PRI.org. Pierce, thanks again.
Thank you.
And we'll stick with the old-school hip-hop vibe. Here's Queen Latifah and Unity. That's all for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios in Boston at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow. Instinct leads me to another flow. Every time I hear a brother call a girl a bitch or a hoe, trying to make a sister feel low, you know all of that got to go. Now everybody knows there's exceptions to this rule. I don't be getting mad when we playing, it's cool. But don't you be calling me out my name. I bring breath to those who disrespect me like a dame. That's why I'm talking.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.